dinosaur-obsessed children have to learn a new name.
Dreadnoughtus.
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 Is it real? Mama, is it real?
It is real, and it's huge. I'm Maiken Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
When I got here, I felt calm, and I feel relaxed.
It's basically what most of my act is, a parody of a scientific seminar.
It was just everywhere, and I realized looking at it that I was outmatched.
It's a virus that likes to attack lots of different organ systems.
The two-dimensional plane is the dance floor,
it's essentially
and the particles are the dance
floor.
You wouldn't know it's a lot.
My mom said,
"Call 911."
I would say that they're ginormous questions.
On today's show, he was a star surgeon, an innovator, a fabulous dresser, and he collected some of the weirdest things on Earth. We'll take a look at the life of Thomas Dent Mutter, also an update on Pennsylvania's Medicaid expansion. But first up, that new dino. Scientists from Drexel University and the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia have just named that brand new dinosaur the Dreadnoughtus. It's the most complete skeleton ever found for a dinosaur of its size. The 77-million-year-old bones were unearthed in southern Patagonia over the course of 4 years, starting in 2005. The dinosaur was named this week in the journal Scientific Reports. Carolyn Beeler has this story.
The Dreadnoughtus was a plant eater with a long neck, long tail, and a small head. It's a sauropod, like the dinosaur you knew when you were a kid as a brontosaurus, but bigger. It measured 85 feet long, reached 2 stories tall at the shoulders, and weighed 65 tons. Skeletal evidence suggests it wasn't even fully grown yet when it died. Drexel's Kenneth Lacovera and the Academy's Jason Poole have many ways of describing just how massive it was.
It's almost a landmass in itself.
You're talking about a dozen big elephants smushed into one body, or 7 or 8 T-Rex smushed into one body.
The amount of shadow that it produced, I kind of jokingly say it was probably some dinosaurs just standing around in the shade there, taking a smoke break or something, you know.
It's almost unimaginable.
Perhaps the easiest way to visualize the Dreadnoughtus' size is to visit Kenneth Lacovera's paleontology lab at Drexel University.
Hi.
Hello.
Nice to see you.
Good to see you again. Lacovera opens the door wearing a scholarly-looking blazer and a tie with globes printed on it. Every spare surface in the lab behind him is covered in dinosaur bones.
The bones themselves weigh 16 tons.
As you enter, there's a 6-foot femur leaning against a back wall.
That's it. Yeah, that was the discovery piece that I found.
A huge work table covered with sternum and backbones to your right.
You can see they're very, very big.
And the vertebrae of a 30-foot-long tail on a counter at your left.
It extends in my room here across one wall and then turns the corner and goes across the other wall.
Lacovera opens a drawer and shows me a tray of fossils shaped like wishbones. They used to attach to the bottom of those tail vertebrae.
This shelf is full of what we call chevrons, and that's a pair of bones that hangs under each tailbone.
In other sauropods, he explains, these chevrons taper down to a little point, like a V.
And it's one of the unique features of Dreadnoughtus. Instead of tapering to a little point, these bones flare out into what looks like a spatula.
That thicker shape at the bottom leaves lots of room for giant tail-wagging muscles coming from the thigh to attach. That tells Lacovera that the tail itself was a powerful weapon.
We can see that it has muscular control all the way down to the very tip of its tail. And so it could club a big predator to death with its tail, or it could flick a fly with the end of its tail.
The limb bones Lacovera uncovered have deep scars where huge muscles attached. This was a wide-set, bulky dinosaur, invulnerable to predators.
That evokes, in my mind, this class of turn-of-the-last-century battleships that were called the Dreadnoughts. And they were made of thick steel and very, very big, and they could basically sail the seas with impunity. So I've decided to name this dinosaur Dreadnoughtus, which means fears nothing. In part because I think that herbivores don't really get their due for being ferocious.
Take, for example, Dino, the cartoon Flintstone family's pet purple dinosaur, a sauropodish creature.
Uh-oh, it's Dino, sound asleep. What a break.
In one episode of the cartoon, Fred Flintstone tries to sneak past a snoring Dino on his way home from work.
Hey!
No dice.
Put it out! Double kill!
The slobbering Dino jumps on Fred and showers him with licks and kisses. Plant eaters are often portrayed as the sympathetic cousins to bloodthirsty carnivores like the T-Rex. But Lacovara says herbivores make up the biggest animals on Earth and at sea, and they deserve our respect.
If you look at large land animals today, the most dangerous ones are plant eaters. More people are injured in Yellowstone National Park by buffalo than ever by grizzly bears. The most dangerous animal in Africa is a hippo. And so I wanted to kind of honor, in a way, this amazing species by giving credit to its size and ferocity.
The Dreadnoughtus discovery is scientifically significant because so many bones were unearthed. That's in sharp contrast to the fragmentary remains of other dinosaurs of this size, known as titanosaurs.
Most dinosaurs, if you can imagine a dinosaur the size of a house, it dies, it falls over on a floodplain, very little of its body is in contact with the earth. So very few of those bones have the opportunity to be buried and turn into fossils.
There are four or five other dinosaurs we think approach this massive body size, and none of them is known from more than just three or four bones from the whole skeleton.
That's Christy Curry Rogers, a paleontologist and sauropod expert at McAllister College in Minnesota.
So Dreadnoughtus is really, especially for these super massive dinosaurs, is in a class all its own.
This specimen died in a flood and was mired in quicksand, which preserved about 70% of the bones from the neck down. Rogers says because it is so complete, it can be used as a template for other found remains, a keystone animal.
They fill in the blank spaces that allow us to compare the isolated femur from Thailand with the isolated skull from Madagascar. And that allows us to make interpretations about evolution, but also about anatomy in general, how these animals looked from head to tail.
Kenneth Lacovara uncovered the very first Dreadnoughtus bone back in 2005 at a field site in southern Patagonia that was reachable originally only by rafting down a glacial stream.
I was sitting on a barren sandstone hill. We have the Andes Mountains in sight. You can see the snow-capped peaks. Every day you see giant Andean condors with a 9-foot wingspan.
Lacovara said in this epic setting, the moments following his discovery were pure magic.
This individual hasn't seen the light of day, in this case, in 77 million years. And then when you find a new species for a little bit, you're the only human that has ever known this. And so I remember sitting there that night kind of by myself and looking at this new dinosaur, wondering, who are you? What did you do for a living? What was it like then? And all these questions, and you start to imagine its environment. And it's the thing that keeps us all doing this.
It took four field seasons to excavate more than 100 bones. Once the bones were shipped to Philadelphia, Jason Poole led the fossil prep at the Academy of Natural Sciences. Even in his museum office, Poole looks ready to head out into the field again in a khaki-colored cargo vest and leather boots. He says the skeleton has already shed light on how titanosaurs moved. Mostly, he says, in first gear.
These were really slow, plodding dinosaurs. They'd probably go into an area, start to eat, let their necks kind of careen around like a big vacuum cleaner, and then take a couple steps to the side, you know, and that was it. There's no running. It's a mountain moving.
Drexel teams have 3D scanned all the bones and put them online, and they are 3D printing them to create a robotic version of Dreadnoughtus to model how it moved.
So all this stuff together is really hard for somebody to sit there and just imagine, but when you have a computer and it's sort of getting it to walk through these things, it's kind of neat to see.
Kenneth Lacovara says he'll be sad to put the Dreadnoughtus bones on a ship next year and return them, as required by Argentinian law.
I suppose after almost 10 years working on this project, I have a sort of a love-hate relationship with this dinosaur. I'll be very forlorn when I see this thing finally steam out of Philadelphia.
For The Pulse, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
You're so sweet to
see photos of these 77 million-year-old dinosaur bones, check out our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And this is perhaps not the most scientific take, but here's what 6-year-old June Whitman has to say about this new find, which is, after all, just an herbivore.
Do you have a favorite dinosaur?
T-Rex.
Why is it your favorite?
Because it eats meat.
So there's, what if there's a really, really big dinosaur that doesn't eat meat? What do you think of that?
It's not so cool. It's a vegetarian, so it wouldn't really eat humans.
So you like the T-Rex because it might eat you?
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. The debate over Medicaid expansion in Pennsylvania has largely centered around people in the gap. People like David Coleman of Philadelphia. He was eager to sign up for health insurance once the Affordable Care Act went into effect, but
I found out that I made too much for Medicaid and that I didn't make enough to get the benefits of the Obamacare.
Now, that's about to change. The decision is in. Pennsylvania will get an influx of billions of federal dollars in coming years to welcome more people into its Medicaid program. Whether you call it an expansion or an expansion alternative, it's a different design than traditional Medicaid. Tanya English reports.
Today, when people in the gap go to the Obamacare marketplace to shop, they're often surprised to learn that they don't qualify for discounts and tax breaks. Under the federal health law, single people who make around $12,000 a year were supposed to get their coverage through an expanded Medicaid program. But in Pennsylvania, initially, that expansion didn't happen. Lisa Allen is Pennsylvania's Medicaid director.
Now our rules have changed. They become part of the newly eligible population.
Opponents wanted to reserve Medicaid only for the most vulnerable people. They argued that it's too costly to allow childless, able-bodied adults into the program. But starting next year, people in the gap will enroll in the Corbett-designed Medicaid alternative. Lisa Allen says the idea is to get low-wage earners really used to the way healthcare works in the private sector.
We really were looking for this to be a pathway to employer-sponsored coverage. We wanted it to look and feel like employer-sponsored coverage.
Some participants in Corbett's alternative Medicaid plan will pay premiums or monthly bills. People will chip in $20 to $25 a month toward their coverage, but could get some discounts if they follow through with some healthy behaviors, like going for a yearly checkup.
You know, our data has shown when folks lead healthier lives that overall healthcare spending goes down.
In the official agreement, the federal government said no to one of Corbett's most controversial proposals. He wanted to link job search requirements to health coverage. But using state dollars, Pennsylvania is moving forward anyway, with a program to encourage employment. Allen says newly eligible Medicaid participants will get a career coach and help looking for work.
As well as training, maybe some GED, help with GED classes, help with resume writing, interviewing skills.
Can people really reduce their healthcare costs by doing some of those activities?
Yes, actually that is our goal, is to have them have a reduction in their premium costs in year two.
That's a departure from the way the Department of Welfare manages Medicaid now. Genevieve Kenny is an economist with the left-leaning Urban Institute.
What it means is that within the agency, you're going to have to develop a unit that's dedicated to tracking receipt of premiums and keeping track of that on a monthly basis for beneficiaries.
Pennsylvania is setting up a separate parallel Medicaid system. And Kenny says the bureaucracy of collecting a string of small premium payments may get expensive. Besides, she says, there's good evidence that asking very low-income people to pay a monthly bill before they even use their health insurance discourages some from buying coverage at all.
It can get pretty complicated. It can end up being a net cost to the state and not generate the savings that may be anticipated.
Analysts also wonder if the health system is ready to absorb all these new card-carrying Medicaid enrollees. Other expansion states have not had a whole lot of difficulty booking people in for doctor's appointments. But in Pennsylvania, some counties are already considered primary care shortage areas. Kenny says Pennsylvania should expect to rely even more on mid-level healthcare professionals.
Nurse practitioners, not physicians, but highly trained primary care providers that can share the primary care workload with the primary care doctors.
Enrollment for the newly eligible Medicaid participants begins in December, and Pennsylvania officials say they're already testing out their sign-up systems. People should be able to enroll online, go to a county assistance office, or call the state's customer service helpline. New coverage starts January 2015. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
One of the people affected by the Medicaid expansion will be David Coleman of Philadelphia. He's a 24-year-old bus driver. He spoke to Alana Gordon about some of his experiences of living without health insurance and his hopes for attaining it.
This was about 2013, and what was happening was I was getting chest pains, and I couldn't explain it. And it felt like, you know, it felt like maybe a heart attack. But every time when I went into the emergency room, they say everything is fine, nothing is no problem. And then once I really start opening those letters and those bills from the emergency room, basically I call it a don't waste my time bill of $8,000 at one time. That's when I just, you know what, I really fell on the ground and passed out. I don't need to go to the hospital.
What came of that?
I haven't found out yet. I haven't found out yet because I haven't had insurance to get to a doctor. Everybody wants at least $60 to $80 a visit.
Do you think about that very much?
I try not to. I try not to think about it very much because then that would kind of consciously or unconsciously bring that pain back to my chest, and I don't want to do it. I just try to what I try to do is block it out by keep working out, keep drinking much water as possible, and staying healthy. That's all I try to do. Well, one of the things I have is the Vitamin Shoppe Healthy Rewards Awards Club member so that I can get certain multivitamin packs for a discounted rate. The gym, it has been recently of this year, but kind of like trying to eat right a little bit better, always having greens or something like that.
So what's at stake for you? Like, what would it mean to have an insurance card?
It would mean security. It would mean being able to know what's going on within myself and be able to get the proper assistance I need to make sure I can keep myself healthy, other than the stuff I can look on YouTube for.
Philadelphian David Coleman will qualify for the Medicaid expansion in Pennsylvania, and this is some music he produced. Coming up on The Pulse, what's the universe trying to tell us, and are we picking up the message?
Because it's a single pulse, a single event. You could actually imagine an extraterrestrial civilization producing this, either by accidentally or on purpose.
Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca is dedicated to improving health in communities across the Philadelphia region. On Twitter at AstraZeneca US or on Facebook at AstraZeneca US Community Connections.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence Blue Cross is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents will be available to help clear up confusion, answer questions, and even help you decide on a policy. IBC is dedicated to helping you make the best decision with your health insurance. The Independence Express truck is visiting neighborhoods now. More information online at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. The last time you found yourself gazing up at the stars, did you think, oh, this is nice, so quiet and relaxing? But that peacefulness, I don't want to shatter it for you, but space is really not all that tranquil. from the steady beat of a pulsar to the electromagnetic waves of Saturn. The universe is clearly trying to tell us something. The newest noisemaker is something called a fast radio burst, and astronomers say it could provide clues for solving some deep space mysteries. Todd Bookman explains.
All right, listen close, because it's only a fraction of a second long. That's real time. Let's play it again, slowed down. That is a fast radio burst, and the man who discovered it is Duncan Lorimer. He's a West Virginia University professor. Back in 2007, he and a graduate student were sifting through some data collected by a huge radio telescope in Australia, the Parkes Telescope, 210 feet wide, famously located in the middle of a sheep paddock. Anyways, they were looking at all the routine signals that come from our own galaxy when they came across this strange blip, this spike in the radio waves.
It had very different properties to what we were expecting. It appeared to be much, much further away. So we were completely flabbergasted. It was very surprising. We just didn't know what to make of it.
Neither did the scientific community. It was the first time anything like this had been captured. People started referring to it as the Lorimer burst.
Well, you know, it's a nice thing to have. It's not, personally, it's not that important in the grand scheme of things, but it's a nice thing to tell your grandchildren about, I suppose.
Nice, yes, but without a second one on record, there were lots of doubts about what actually caused it. Maybe it was just some radio static or interference or a glitch in the software. 4 years went by, a very nerve-wracking 4 years for Lorimer, before anything similar to his burst appeared again in the sky. But then it happened. Parkes Telescope grabbed another one, and then, crucially, a different telescope. This one in Puerto Rico spotted a burst. It was clear this wasn't a fluke. With only a few on record, though, it's tough to study them. Radio telescopes, despite their massive size, aim a fairly narrow beam at the sky. Some describe it as tunnel vision. And so it takes a while for a burst to pass through the sweet spot. Today, there's only about 10 on record, but scientists think there could be as many as 10,000 of them whizzing toward Earth every day, with some coming from very far away. At least, that's what their signal is suggesting.
And what we can see is that the waves arrive earliest at the telescope at the highest frequencies, and they sort of whistle across our telescope's range of frequencies. It's like a sort of a chirp.
The telescope, to be clear, doesn't actually hear a chirp. We've converted it into a wavelength that the human ear can detect. That scale, the high to low we hear, is caused by the different frequencies arriving at different times. They all start out together in space, but the lower frequencies get slowed down by the electrons they encounter on their long journey to Earth, sort of like hitting traffic. The time in between the highs and the lows, the short delay, allows astronomers to estimate the distance traveled. Lorimer says his burst may have gone 1 billion light years. 1 billion light years. I mean, it sounds like a Hollywood script.
2, 3, 5, 7. Those are all prime numbers. And there's no way that's a natural phenomenon.
Professor, do you know that movie from the late 90s with Jodie Foster?
Are you talking about Contact? Yeah, I know it.
What do you think of it?
Oh, I loved it. Yeah, it's a great movie. I used to work at the Arecibo Observatory where that was filmed. So it brings back a lot of memories every time I see it.
Who would you want to play you in the sequel?
I wouldn't mind a crack at it myself.
There may not be a Contact 2 on the horizon, but if you've seen the first, you may remember that the source of those radio transmissions is, well, it's aliens.
That is, that has been discussed quite a bit. Because it's a single pulse, a single event, you could actually imagine an extraterrestrial civilization producing this, either by accidentally or on purpose, you know, for instance, during one of their nuclear wars or something.
Alien nuclear war as the source? Well, probably not. Lorimer puts that pretty low on the list of possibilities. But at this point, nothing is ruled out. More likely origins are things like blitzars, which is a neutron star that, as it collapses into a black hole, sends out a flash of energy. Or it could be a flare sent off by a magnetar. They're spinning stars with a really strong magnetic field.
Something more exotic is the evaporation of a black hole formed in the early universe due to Hawking radiation that was very famously proposed by Stephen Hawking about 30 years ago. So that's, again, there would be an associated radio pulse with the final death throes of a black hole. The list goes on.
At this point, there are more theories than recorded bursts. While astronomers may not yet have a definitive source, they still see huge potential in what they could learn. Keith Bannister is a researcher based in Sydney, Australia, about 5 hours' drive from the telescope that has collected so many of these pulses. We connected over a fuzzy Skype line.
The organization I work for was responsible for inventing Wi-Fi largely, and the Wi-Fi in our place is hopeless, so, you know, it doesn't win you much.
Bannister says that the data for each burst doesn't just provide an indication of how far it traveled, but also the road it took to get here.
When we detect one of these bursts, it carries with it a very distinctive signature that we can measure very accurately, and that signature, it tells you how much gas that the burst has gone through. They get that signature imprinted on them. Then if we find enough of them, we can actually essentially weigh how much gas there is in that part of the universe, which is a measurement that hasn't ever been possible before.
With that measurement, scientists could nail down what's in between galaxies. Or, Duncan Lorimer says, maybe learn more about the magnetic field of the universe. Really big picture stuff.
They're not going to solve any of mankind's problems right here on Earth. And you probably already knew that. But for astronomers, they're very interesting if we can figure out what they are and how far away they are.
Even with more radio telescopes looking for bursts, Lorimer says it may take 3 to 5 years to answer those questions, unless the signal is coming from aliens. They may stop by even sooner. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
You're listening to The Pulse. Philadelphia's Mutter Museum is a huge attraction for lovers of the bizarre. Skulls in all shapes and sizes line the walls. There are the famous conjoined twins, the woman with the horn on her forehead, but it's really a tribute to a surgeon who changed medicine and how it's taught. Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz has written a new book about the famous doctor. It's called Dr. Mutter's Marvels. I caught up with Aptowitz at the location where she did most of her research.
Kristen, thank you so much for being on The Pulse. Tell me, where are we? What is this space?
We're right now in the archives and special collection of Jefferson University here in Philadelphia in the Scott Memorial Library. And it's where I spent probably the bulk of my research for the book, Dr. Mutter's Marvels.
Now, you say Mutter. I would say Mutter. And some people say Mutter. Yeah. So how do you say it?
I say Mutter. Thomas was born in Virginia in 1811, and his name did not include the umlaut when he was born. So people tend to believe that he was born with the name Mutter, Tom Mutter. But when he went to Paris to study under the amazing surgeons that were working during that time period, this is about the 1830s, he was inspired by European surgery and European innovation. And when he came back to Philadelphia, he decided to add the umlaut. And I believe when he made that choice, he also decided to alter the pronunciation of his name. That's why I say Mutter, although no one actually knows how his name is pronounced.
Thomas Mutter was orphaned at a young age, had a kind of a tough beginning. How did he get into medicine?
His entire family died within about 7 years of his birth. His little brother died first, then his mother, then his father. He was sent to live with his grandmother, and shortly after that, his grandmother died. He himself was always in poor health. So I think that from a very early age, his relationship to medicine was something that was important. He could differentiate between helpful medicine and unhelpful medicine, and knew how he wanted to be treated. And it was also, you know, a time in America when the class system was very rigid, and medicine, and particularly surgery, was one of those fields where you were based on your talent. If you were a skilled surgeon, people would go out of their way to come to you for service. And that is what happened with Mutter's life. He became extraordinarily skilled in surgery, and people from all over the country and all over the world would come to seek his services.
He learned some of those techniques in Paris after graduating from the University of Pennsylvania, something called Les Opérations Plastiques.
Right.
But, yeah, we're talking there lots of things that are tough to pronounce today. So what is that? What did he learn?
Right. I think that contemporary people view plastic surgery. We think of cosmetic surgery. We think of nose jobs and boob jobs. But plastic surgery literally means using the plastic of your skin, you know, plasticity, to help correct something that is defective within you. So in Mutter's time, it kind of would be more seen as reconstructive surgery. So there were people who had horrible cleft palates, burn victims who were unable to close their mouths because of the severity of their burns. They didn't have grafting back then. Limbs injured, club foot.
And those people lived really marginalized existences. He talks about fixing monsters.
Yes. I mean, if you look at the Mutter Museum collection and you look at the early inventory, they actually have monsters is a medical term. They'd have a jar of monster, and that just means that they had a human that was so deformed that they just categorized it as monsters, just like they categorized people as idiots, and that was a medical term back then. Many times these people were hidden away, and they would not see the light of day, and it took a lot of bravery for them to come out into the public and to go to Mutter for treatment. And this was before anesthesia. So all of the surgeries that he did prior to 1846 were all done on people who were wide awake.
Once he returned to Philadelphia, where did his career go? What did he do?
So when he first came back to Philadelphia, he was a very flamboyant, brash young man. He loved to dress very extravagantly and would be known for matching his suit to his horse to his carriage. But he did not find immediate success. They were very alienated. The Philadelphia Medical Society was very prissy and regimented, and they felt like you needed to follow certain rules, and he did not believe in those rules. And then in 1841, Jefferson Medical College, which was the second medical college here in Philadelphia, the first one being the first ever in America, University of Pennsylvania, they found Mutter. And Mutter, at 31, was the youngest professor brought on, and he was made the chair of surgery.
What are some of his biggest contributions to the field of medicine?
The number one contribution that he has is probably the Mutter flap, which is a surgery that he invented that is still being used today, which he invented to treat severe burn victims. And it was essentially an early style of grafting. You know, he had a lot of surgical innovations, but I think the legacy that it leaves as a teacher, the way that he taught generations of medical students to think of patients not as problems to be solved, but as human beings who you're trying to alleviate their suffering. That was a big calling for him, to alleviate human suffering. You know, he was the first one to perform surgery with anesthesia here in Philadelphia. And for years afterwards, the major hospitals banned it. They just could not get behind it. They didn't think it was worth the attention, but he knew.
When did Mutter start collecting things?
You know, it was a thing that most doctors did. A lot of doctors in that time period did, especially doctors who were teaching, because you wanted, if you had an unusual example of something that could happen, it would be helpful to showcase it. And Mutter just happened to have, you know, sort of extreme examples because his work was with radical surgery. But he always collected throughout his life. And it was really funny finding letters in the archives where he's writing about, like, updates in his life. And then there's a postscript that says, by the way, if you find any unusual bones or tumors at your hospital, please let me know. I'd be very interested in seeing them.
Sometimes it feels like the man is overshadowed by his collection. And we talk about the collection almost a bit like a freak show. And that's why people go sometimes. Yeah. So what do you want people to take away?
Where other people saw ugliness, he saw their humanity and wanted to do whatever it took to help bring that humanity to the surface, to alleviate human suffering. And so for Mutter, you know, I think that every aspect of his life, it was about human empathy and human interaction.
Kristen, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz is a poet, and her new book is Dr. Mutter's Marvels, a true tale of intrigue and innovation at the dawn of modern medicine. Coming up on The Pulse, dealing with serious hearing loss and its impact on communication.
So here I am, someone's talking about Phios, and I think that they're talking about Paris, and I'm answering them, I love Paris, my vacation in Paris was the greatest. And meanwhile, they're saying, well, you know, Karen, what are you talking about?
Could specialized cochlear implants be the answer? That's next on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca's patient assistance programs help qualified patients access the AstraZeneca medicines they need while providing them with information that can help them stay healthy. In 2013, AstraZeneca served more than 567,000 patients through its prescription savings programs, including AZ and Me and the MedImmune Assistance Program. Learn more at azandme.com and myaccess360.com.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Way too loud. That's too loud. Okay, thank you. I definitely lost some of my high-frequency hearing going to a Motorhead show in Frankfurt some time ago, but about a million Americans have severe hearing loss at those upper frequencies, especially military veterans and people who work in noisy industrial jobs. That means they have trouble hearing high-pitched sounds. For them, turning up the volume with a hearing aid doesn't really work. But earlier this year, the FDA approved a new type of device that could help, a hybrid cochlear implant. Christopher Intagliata has the story.
Okay, can you hear me? Perfect. So let's just do the beeping sounds. Raise your hand every time you hear it, okay?
Allison Singleton's an audiologist at New York University's Cochlear Implant Center. She's sitting on the other side of the glass, giving a hearing test to her patient, Karen Ryer, here in the sound booth.
Karen, are you hearing it?
Is that it?
Yeah, that's it.
Bill Shapiro, the supervising audiologist here, says Karen has perfectly normal hearing at low frequencies, between 250 and 500 hertz, but she has severe to profound loss at high frequencies. It's sometimes called ski slope hearing loss because of the way a graph of the patient's hearing looks.
We know in speech that the vowels of speech are low frequencies and the consonants are high frequencies. So Karen has all the access to low frequency sounds she needs, but she has no access to the high frequency consonants. And we know in the English language, consonants make up about 75% of the understanding of the word. The difference between carve and car and cat and cap are consonant differences.
To give you a crude approximation of what Bill's talking about, here's that last sentence again, but with a steep cutoff of frequencies above 500 hertz.
The difference between carve and car and cap are consonant differences.
A lot harder to tell the difference between cat and cap, right? Karen tried hearing aids when her hearing started to deteriorate in her early 30s, but turning up the volume still couldn't amplify those crucial high-frequency sounds of speech.
So here I am, someone's talking about Phios, and I think that they're talking about Paris, and I'm answering them, I love Paris, my vacation in Paris was the greatest. And meanwhile, they're saying, well, you know, Karen, what are you talking about? So it becomes really embarrassing and socially for a person who can't hear that you're embarrassed that you're going to, you know, really flub up this entire conversation. So it's a social issue as well as a medical issue.
In 2011, Karen had surgery on her left ear to get what's called a hybrid cochlear implant. Cochlear implants have two parts, external and internal. The external component listens to ambient sounds with a microphone. Then it translates that sound into electrical stimulation using speech processing algorithms. That information then passes through radio waves to the internal device embedded in the patient's skull, which stimulates the inner ear using a string of tiny electrodes threaded into the cochlea. Here's Bill again.
The cochlea is filled with fluid, and it's also filled with hair cells, little hairs. And if you think of the cochlea as a spiral staircase, the pole that holds the spiral staircase up in the middle is where the nerve comes out. So the job of the cochlea is to have those hairs move to this mechanical energy and transduce or change mechanical energy into electrical energy that the nerve understands. So what we're doing is we're taking the place of the hair cells by putting an electrode array into the cochlea.
Traditional cochlear implants have been around for decades, but they were for people who'd lost all their hearing, not people like Karen. Her low-frequency hearing was actually too good for a cochlear implant. That's where this new hybrid cochlear implant comes in, which Karen has. It combines a hearing aid to boost the low-frequency sounds patients can still hear with a cochlear implant, which replaces those missing high-frequency sounds with electrical stimulation. The FDA approved the device earlier this year after reviewing the results of a clinical trial including Karen and 49 other patients. Post-surgery, three-quarters of the patients significantly improved their understanding of words and sentences. But the procedure does have risks. Everyone who's getting this implant still has decent hearing at low frequencies, and that could be erased by the surgery.
When you put an electrode in an ear that's supposed to work a certain way, you're going to typically see that the patient's going to probably lose some of their hearing.
In fact, 22 of the 50 patients in the trial lost all or nearly all they had left of their natural low-frequency hearing in the implanted ear. But the device can be programmed to compensate for that. So for patients who suffered hearing loss during the surgery, their everyday hearing, using both ears, was still as good or better after the surgery than it was before. But electrical stimulation still doesn't capture all the nuances of the human voice.
When I got connected, I could hear and I could understand. It just sounded like people were talking like robots. But hey, talking to robots and being able to understand robots is better than not being able to understand people at all.
Les Atlas, an engineer at the University of Washington in Seattle, created this sample of how a standard cochlear implant processes speech. Here's the unaltered phrase.
The silly boy is hiding.
Now, as a cochlear implant would simulate it.
The silly boy is hiding.
Here's another example.
They painted the wall white.
And now the process speech.
They painted the wall white.
Pretty robotic, right? Karen would hear something a bit better than that since she still has some natural hearing. And the brain's flexible. Over time, it can transform robot speech into something a little more human.
As time goes on, one day, probably about a month later, I said, wait a minute, people sound normal now. So it was just my ear adjusting, and then in about a month or so, it does start to sound like regular speech again.
Bill estimates that about 1 million Americans have ski slope hearing loss, like Karen, and could benefit from this technology, especially military veterans or people who've worked noisy industrial jobs. But it's not cheap. Jay Rubenstein, an otolaryngologist and bioengineer at the University of Washington, says the typical cost for the device, surgery, hospitalization, and a year's worth of audiology support can cost $70,000 per ear, or more. Karen said the charge for her surgery alone was $118,000, though her insurance covered costs after she paid her out-of-pocket maximum. But many other private payers, including UnitedHealthcare, don't cover the hybrid implant yet. And neither does Medicare, because the device was so recently approved. Three months ago, Karen had a hybrid device implanted in her right ear, too, making her the first patient to have hybrids on both sides. And though her speech comprehension has improved, she says music sounds distorted and flat.
Michael Jackson will never sound the same as he used to sound because he was a high-frequency singer. For me, although the second boosted my ability to understand, it changed the nuance a little bit for me.
Here's the sound of a cello, for example. Now, as processed by a cochlear implant. Not nearly as rich a sound. The 22 electrodes on the implant can't provide what Jay Rubinstein calls the broadband spectral resolution necessary to enjoy the complex harmonic ingredients of music. But he and his colleagues are working on that.
We have speech processing strategies that can improve timbre perception. In theory, we could take, a hybrid user, give them a strategy like this, and turn them into sort of a super cochlear implant user. They would not just have great speech perception in quiet and noise and great melody perception through their low-frequency acoustic hearing, but better timbre perception also, and they'd be sort of the superstars of the cochlear implant world.
As for Karen, she says she's more than willing to forego enjoying music in order to hear the voice of her 3-year-old son.
Children are known to have high-frequency voices, and I could understand my son's first words, and now I can understand him perfectly. And knowing what I know now, I would never be able to have that experience if I didn't have the cochlear implant.
For The Pulse, I'm Christopher Intagliato.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. A rather unusual health clinic has opened up in Philadelphia. It's specifically geared toward ex-offenders and people leaving jail or prison. WHYY's Alana Gordon reports on why organizers think such a space is necessary.
Philadelphia Fight is largely known for its work in HIV. But a few weeks ago, it opened at the John Bell Health Center. It's sparse. The paint is still fresh on the walls.
This is the hallway with the exam rooms.
Dr. Franklin Yates says he's only seen a few people, but he's already noticed a trend.
Coming in right off the bat, they have a list of 5-6 medical problems that need to be addressed on the first patient's visit.
Yates says people who've ever been in prison suffer from disproportionate rates of chronic diseases like hepatitis, heart disease, HIV, and diabetes. Hanna Zellman, director of Fight's Institute for Community Justice, says a lot of socioeconomic factors contribute to this.
These are communities of folks with limited access to healthcare infrastructure for whom, there's a lot of kind of life crises and things happening where medical care, access to medical care may not be a priority.
What that means is that jail may actually be the very first time someone sees a doctor. But then?
Their health will deteriorate when they come home.
Prescriptions go unfilled. The risk of death, even in those first 3 weeks, is higher. Zellman and others say all of this fueled the creation of a new clinic, in part funded from a $500,000 federal grant. The goal in this first year is to care for about 1,500 patients. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
It's time now for our series, The Spark, where people in the field of health and science tell us what ignited their passion for their careers and what continues to motivate them. This time we hear from Dr. Abdelmajid Khatraji, who has been treating badly wounded patients in a bare-bones operation room for the past 4 years in Syria, across the border from Turkey. The Michigan-based surgeon is one of the founding doctors of the Syrian American Medical Society, a large network of medical professionals dedicated to providing volunteer medical relief in Syria since the civil war started in 2011. So far, Khatraji has made 8 trips into the region, but was only able to cross the border into Syria 6 times.
When you go in, you come to the border crossing. There's kind of an understanding. They know who you are. You know who they are. This is on the safe side of the border. They smile. They tell you, be safe, and they let you through. This most recent time, however, they told me, don't go through. They literally told me, the guy was just showing me that they'll put a hood over your head and chop off your head. It was one of the most dramatic moments, so they would not let me through. They wouldn't let any American, as a matter of fact, very few of the doctors they would let through just because they knew how precious these doctors are. What we found out was 6 hours later, a bomb exploded right by the hospital that we were going to. So you have to kind of put that in the back of your head that, it wasn't my time. That's where faith for me comes in. You're also worried about your security and your safety, so you have to be very strategic in who you're communicating with, how you're communicating, and you're always meeting in established places that are recognized where medical relief is taking place, where you can say, hey, look, we just want to be able to provide services. The people, a lot of times, will start coming across the border to meet with you, and that's usually the first couple days in which your clinic is actually on the Turkish side in approved locations, and you determine what diagnoses, and you treat like any day in a normal clinic. The surreal thing here is, though, the wounds that you're seeing are things that you don't see in a normal clinic, chemical burns and explosive injuries and concussive injuries, crushing injuries, all sorts of deformities, paralysis, wounds that have healed horribly wrong. At times, you know, the smells that come through your office, the scary thing is you get used to the nuance of dead tissue or damaged tissue from just the odor. The instinct kind of kicks in. You can almost make the diagnosis just by the odor alone. That's just, you know, one of the biggest things we do is try to educate. And at the same time, we learn from the people in the field as well. You pay attention. If you're in a village, what does the village have? What does the resources the village has? So I remember one time we did run out of suture. And we were, you know, we were hard-pressed on what to do. And one lady who was bringing in a patient said, well, I've sewn my children's lacerations using this needle and thread. It was a type of cotton thread. And that's what we used to sew people clothes until we were able to get more thread. We didn't have any type of instrument. So we went to the local mechanic shop to get the Allen wrenches that they had, the regular wrenches that they had, some bolt cutters. We put them in the sterilizer, which what we could, and we also used alcohol to clean them up as best as possible, and that's what we used. You're going back to the basics. You know, in so many ways, it grounds me. I don't know how to explain. You know, it makes me appreciate what I have so much more. The amount of time you spend not being able to be a physician when you're in practice here because of politics and rules and meetings and bickering and... There, you're only going there to be a doctor. There's no politics there. No one cares how many patients you saw or whether you're taking over their turf or territory. All the physicians are working together to achieve the same goal, to help people who desperately need it. When you go there, it makes you feel the love of why you became a doctor again.
Dr. Abdelmajid Katraji is one of the founding doctors of the Syrian American Medical Society. Elizabeth Perez Luna produced this piece. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, and Alana Gordon. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson, the associate producer. Megan Pinto, our executive producer. Chris Satullo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey is our chief content officer. Did you miss some of this show? Any of our previous shows? They are all great. You can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And we always love to hear from you, so please email us with your questions, your feedback, your ideas at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.